Broadsides here at beautiful Free Radio Santa Cruz, 89.3 FM. And here we have Peggy Seeger to introduce the show.
Fishermen and miners as well. Now all you who hear me, I pray you draw near me before you grow weary. I'll sing of myself. I was brought up in plenty until I was 20. Adjured myself as but children can be. Adjured my father, adjured my mother. The pain of my country was nothing to me. My school days being over, I became a rover. To Russia and China, to France and to Spain. I lived at my leisure, I lived before pleasure, and so none the wiser to England I came. I thought it no danger to follow a stranger, but with for the joys of a lover can equal no other, forever anew and yet always the same. Good fortune attending, we don't lack our living. Our children a blessing, our joy to renew. But to live amid plenty can only torment me, when the wealth of the country belongs to the few. I join with the angry, I join with the hungry. For long years of anguish, the price will be paid. To hate and to anger, I'm not a stranger. I welcome the danger, and yet I'm afraid. For I fear the fate of the rebels and fighters who ransom the future with torture and pain. I as the trial comes near, if I find I can bear it, with joy I will share it, no longer afraid. For I've learned to be angry, I've learned to be lonely, I've learned to be many, I've learned to be one. I've earned all my friends, even foes will commend me. I stand with the many, I am not alone. In the presence of fighters, I find a new peace. In the company of workers, replenish myself. Of miners and weavers, of rebels and dreamers, when I sing of my brothers, I sing of myself.
And that was Peggy Seeger, folk singer, political activist, and a real fine person, from Songs of Love and Politics, Folkways Years, 1955-1992. She's been around a long time. And this is Bathrobes Pierre Robert Norse, or Bathrobes Pierre, as you can call me.
Just after the November 94 elections, and Berkeley's acting mayor...
Today we have an abbreviated show, because I'm a bit under the weather, so I'm going to try to throw in a lot of interesting music, more satire from the Jolly Roger comedy troupe of Berkeley, which you heard last Friday on my show. And again, I have hopes that outside all you potential satirists out there will get it together.
If we don't improve the shopping climate in Berkeley, my downtown Berkeley association is going to lose credibility, not to mention...
Whoops. I'm afraid that we actually went into the Jolly Roger comedy troupe. The equipment got ahead of me there. But we'll have some of that, but that'll be a bit later. Now we're going to work on some announcements. And we're going to update you on the situation in Berkeley. I'm going to Berkeley first because, as you may remember from last Friday, the University of California has apparently decided that People's Park, the park four blocks from the University of California just above Telegraph Avenue, which was the scene of so much protest and community support in the 60s and actually for the last 25 years, is now to be further yuppified. People's Park was the scene of a lot of violence and a lot of police repression when the university moved in 1991 to set up a Redwood volleyball sports court, which essentially no one has used, or very few, since that time, as part of a plan to make the park more upscale and drive the homeless to other areas of the city, which is, of course, what seems to be happening in numerous cities. And I'll be reading you some articles from different parts of the country and from different papers to kind of give you a more national perspective on that, as well as discussing local issues around that. There's a very good article in Slingshot, which is an anarchist newspaper published every few months up in Berkeley, which I'm going to read you from. It's called Will Peace Survive in People's Park? And this is looks like an unsigned article, or maybe it does have someone's name at the bottom of it, but I read it, it's pretty good. Oh, it's signed by Steve. So let me give you some of this article, see if you like it. And incidentally, if you have any criticisms or comments, give me a call at 423-4833. That's 423-4833. It's not the number of the radio station, although we will be having a number shortly. We're actually trying to get solicit funding for a phone patch. We have a phone, but it's not yet patched into the air. But if you want to leave comments for me, call my answering machine number at 423-4833, and I will answer your calls later. I won't be able to do it now I'm on the air. If you want to donate to Free Radio Santa Cruz, send a check, money, or green stamps, whatever you got, to Free Radio, P.O. Box 7652, Santa Cruz, California, 95061. Also send any literature you think would be relevant or pertinent. And if you want to get on the air, you can drop us a note, or again, you can leave me a message on the phone, 423-4833. Getting back to Berkeley and People's Park, here is this article from the summer 1995 of Slingshot. In February 1996, the five-year lease agreement between the university and the city of Berkeley over People's Park will expire. Both governments must develop a new policy regarding Berkeley's most famous block. The result may either be the realization of the original dream of People's Park or an apocalyptic nightmare tearing the city to pieces. After 20 years of pretending the park would go away, the university tried a new tactic. The area would be allowed as open space provided that total gentrification of the park as well as the surrounding neighborhood was effected with the cooperation of the city. Already at work cleansing the Shattuck downtown area of undesirables, city leaders joined enthusiastically. The lease agreement allowed professional athletic facilities to be constructed on the People's Park lawn to draw upper-class conservative students. Requirements to increase the use by all segments of the community, reduce crime, and treat the park like other parks are Orwellian doublespeak for eliminating the poor, homeless, and countercultural people who use the park. Sensing a direct attack, activists and poor people fought in the streets for days after the construction of volleyball courts began. Through constant vigilance, the user-developed free speech stage and free clothing box were preserved, the volleyball court fell into disuse, and people in need gathered daily for sustenance. At the same time, although grassroots native plant gardening continued, the city and university gradually exerted more control over the physical landscape of the park. At the beginning of the lease, a Use and Standard Evaluation, or Use Committee, USE, was formed with 9 members, each appointed by the city and the university, to advise the city and university of what to do with the park. Needless to say, an alliance between university representatives and the city representatives appointed by moderate, Berkeley doublespeak for conservative or reactionary, city council members usually created a moderate, quote-unquote, majority. Not taken seriously at first, the Use Committee became more important later on as a means of validating moderate proposals that high-ranking officials did not want to take personal responsibility for. Currently, the Useless Committee, as some of us call it, is being used as a front for public process. While private meetings strategize the establishment's plan of attack, the public is invited to spew their concerns to an unresponsive, stacked, and politically impotent committee. For example, a public input meeting for People's Park as a part of the University Art Exhibit's Revisioning South Side actually produced many creative, popular, and inspiring proposals. Unfortunately, they were completely ignored when the committee voted instead to approve a 13-point plan emanating from the closed office of a city manager flunky. Even the subcommittee process became a farce as there became so many little, often conflicting and unannounced meetings that even a dedicated activist couldn't keep track. Food Not Bombs members found a services subcommittee meeting moved without notice of where and therefore missed a discussion in which rich college boys proposed moving and impeding free food services in the park. Although the highest-ranking city and university officials speak in favor of maintaining the park as some sort of open space, any form of land use besides buildings, they frame the choice between losing the park as open space at all and maintaining it according to the lease, in other words, between annihilation and gentrification. To accomplish this, many drastic proposals are up for consideration. Over the past 25 years, user development has produced the best People's Park has to offer. Throughout the five-year lease agreement, the university and the city have broadly targeted grassroots design elements. The gardens at the end of the park have been maintained by volunteers for years. The university has hired another gardener who spends 40 hours a week, often destroying native plants planted by volunteers. Before the Use Committee now are proposals to completely determine the landscape of the park gardens through a centralized plan, encouragingly easy to maintain low-variety landscapes over diverse native plant mixtures and volunteer gardens. In other words, they want to kick out the native plants and the community activists who are doing this and put in a university gardener. One of the stupidest arguments for attacking the green of a park, and this is seen in cities throughout the country, is to remove places where criminals can hide their drugs and to allow police to see from end to end. This is what happened to the Pacific Garden Mall. The Bassett-Wormhout plan to renovate the mall, which was redone after the earthquake, had this as a priority. Straighten it up, remove the bushes, remove the shrubbery, allegedly to stop the dope dealers and the criminals. It actually, of course, makes it a much more sterile environment. Well, my voice is going, guys. So what I'm going to do here is suggest you pick up a copy of Slingshot, the summer issue. And if you don't know where, give me a call at 423-4833, and I will put you onto a copy. And in the meantime, we'll go back. We'll go back and attempt to tell you some of the Jolly Roger comedy troupe that you heard at the beginning of the show. And this time maybe you'll be able to understand it because the volume will be up. This is a comedy troupe that goes out, I don't know, weekly, bi-weekly, perhaps more than that, over Radio Free Berkeley, which was just about the first station to start micro-broadcasting. And the topics they cover are Berkeley topics, so some of the references will be unfamiliar to you, but I think you'll find it amusing and inspirational, and maybe you can get, as I said, one of you to sit down and write a satire here for Santa Cruz. So here it comes, Jolly Roger Comedy Troupe.
It's just after the November 94 elections, and Berkeley's acting mayor, Jeffrey Wall Street Leiter, is despondent. Even after outlawing panhandling and loitering, the downtown is still in decline. He convenes yet another Blue Ribbon Commission, and this one is really blue.
Gentlemen, please, this is serious. If we don't improve the shopping climate in Berkeley, my downtown Berkeley Association is going to lose credibility, not to mention funding. I've hired a $50,000 consultant to help us analyze the problem. Ms. Frazier?
Thank you, Mayor Leiter. We've used the most modern electronic technology to analyze the Berkeley virtual shopping experience. Put on your virtual shopping helmets and your virtual shopping gloves, and let's go shopping! All right, commissioners, point your virtual shopping gloves to the right, and we'll encounter the traditional Berkeley scapegoat, the panhandler.
Excuse me, gentlemen. Could I trouble you for a modest contribution to a worthy cause?
Oh, that's it! That's the problematic street behavior that's destroying my property values and driving shoppers to Emeryville! Get it, boys!
The Women's Commission brutally beats to death a panhandler in broad daylight, leaving him in a bloody heap on the sidewalk.
Gentlemen, please, you really didn't need to kill the poor man. Our intercept study proves that panhandlers are not the problem.
Kill the intercept study, boys!
Together. My company's scientific analysis proves that Berkeley has some serious problems that really need addressed.
But we've beaten the panhandler to death. Doesn't that solve everything? What else could our shopping problem be?
Please, gentlemen, point your virtual shopping gloves and your virtual shopping helmets towards the street out here.
Good heavens, what are all those vehicles whizzing by?
They
must be doing over 60 miles an hour.
Are these Southside radical anarchists on skateboards?
No! Those are the parking control vehicles giving out tickets.
Why are they going so fast?
Why, because they have a quota, of course. If they don't meet their ticket quota, they lose their jobs. But even that's not downtown Berkeley's main problem. Come with me, please, gentlemen.
Ooh, this is spooky.
Where are we now?
It's so empty in here.
Miss Frazier, what are we doing in this big empty building?
Take a good look around you, gentlemen. Turn your virtual shopping helmets completely around and experience with your virtual shopping gloves the real reason for downtown Berkeley's decline.
But Miss Frazier, there's nothing here.
Exactly. You see, panhandlers aren't the problem in downtown Berkeley. The problem is that the rents are so high, businesses can't afford the overhead. It's the greed of the property owners who set these high rents that creates completely empty storefronts like the one we're in right now. And why go shopping in downtown Berkeley if there's nothing to buy?
Miss Frazier, could you excuse the commission for just a moment?
Why, of course.
Okay, listen, boys. I own this building, and between us and the rest of the Downtown Berkeley Association Board of Directors, we own the whole block. We can't let this woman run around saying our rents are too high.
But what will we do?
She's right. We can't let this get around.
I want to raise my rent even higher anyway.
Just leave it to me. We'll just lock the door. And I assure you, Miss Frazier will have trouble finding an audience.
Hello? Hello? Mayor Leiter? Commissioners? Did you lock this door by mistake? Hello? Hello? There must be some mistake. Hello? Mayor Leiter? Commissioners?
And that was the Jolly Roger Comedy Troupe. Compliments of Radio Berkeley, or Free Radio Berkeley. And you're back with Bathrobes Pierre's broadsides and his battered voice. And it's interesting that the comedians talk about ticket quotas, because I have here an article from the San Jose Mercury News of May 13th, which actually documents that rumor and that mythology and that truth that we had all kind of taken for granted but never had anything really substantial to back it up with. The idea that different agencies do have quotas for parking tickets and so forth. And here's the story by Gary Webb from Sacramento in the Mercury News. Quote, the belief that cops have traffic ticket quotas is one of the stubborn public suspicions that persist in the face of years of official denials, like rumors of secret UFO crashes in the desert. But the traffic quota myth isn't so mythical in California anymore. State records show there is such a system in place, and every county in the state has a quota. Last year, according to records at the State Comptroller's Office, four Bay Area counties were fined more than $1.3 million by the state for falling short of their quotas. The quota system, which began last year, doesn't work like most people would imagine. Officer Friendly doesn't get marching orders to write 50 tickets a week or else. It exists on a much grander scale. Under the law, all of the Officer Friendlies in each county have to raise as much money from traffic tickets as they did in 1992-93. If they don't, the taxpayers in those counties must fork over the difference to the state. Last year, for example, Santa Clara County, which is where San Jose is, got a ticket, so to speak, for $237,952, the amount the state says the county's motorists should have paid in traffic fines, but didn't. The take was down, police say, because 12% fewer tickets were issued last year. Alameda County got hit with an $877,000 fine, the second highest amount in the state, behind bankrupt Orange County, which owed $907,000. In all, 28 of the state's 58 counties didn't reach their quotas last year, and that's after the state lowered them because they were originally too high, set on the 1991-92 revenues. An obvious concern is that counties faced with looming shortfalls will pressure police to step up ticket-writing campaigns to meet their quotas. Conceivably, that could happen, said Ruben Lopez, a consultant with the Assembly Judiciary Committee, but that can be said about any system which bases its revenue sources on fines and forfeitures. Some counties say that in order to meet their quota, they would have to write 60% more tickets. The quota system was created in 1991 by Assemblyman Phil Eisenberg, Democrat of Sacramento, to help pay for the state courts. 75% of all fines and bail forfeitures collected by the counties were required to be sent to the state, which then divides the money between counties and sends back a proportional amount to pay for things like judges' salaries and trial costs. State officials admit that the idea isn't working as they had planned, but they suspect that counties aren't trying very hard to meet their quotas. They think local officials miffed that they now must send 75% of all the fines they collect to the state are losing interest in writing tickets. The counties collectively have to send to the state $80.1 million a year in fines and forfeitures. Last fiscal year, according to the State Comptroller's Office, they fell $17 million short. Of that, counties have paid roughly $4 million so far. And the article goes on. Santa Cruz, according to the California State Association of Counties, in a little news box in the midst of the article, owes the state $136,000 because it didn't meet its ticket quota, along with Alameda County, San Francisco County, Santa Clara County. So, what you have are police being pressured to write tickets where there is no legitimate cause otherwise, simply to grind out more money for the state, which is, of course, what we knew to begin with. We don't call John Mulligan, the court referee of the basement traffic court, Meat Grinder Mulligan for nothing. I mean, the reason we call him that name, Meat Grinder Mulligan, is because that's his job, to keep squeezing people for more and more money to pay for this judicial bureaucracy, which, of course, is as to justice the way music is to military marching music, or vice versa, I should say. In other words, it ain't no justice, and particularly for lower-income people. Well, let's see what the Jolly Roger Comedy Troupe has to say about another subject, and I'll be back.
Burglary, and they asked if I had any criminal records, so, you know, I told them.
Well, that's pretty stupid.
Yeah, it is, I guess.
And a great start for our show. Okay. Now, let's meet contestant.
Sorry about that, folks. We did that one last week, so we're going to give you the proper Jolly Roger.
Storefront vacant until she starts today?
Yeah, that could take a long time.
I sure hope she can't get out of there.
Don't worry, Dallas. With a portfolio like mine, I can leave that storefront empty for years without feeling it. We've already torn up her intercept study, so we're home free. We just blame the panhandlers.
All right, let's go play laser tag.
Nah, let's kill another panhandler. That was fun.
Yeah.
Berkeley cares.
Nah.
The Downtown Berkeley Association went on a spree that night, leaving dozens of dead panhandlers, most of whom had been strangled, their mouths stuffed with Berkeley Care vouchers. Ms. Frazier mysteriously disappeared that night, never to be seen again. Lighter storefronts are still empty, and we'll be bringing you regular updates on the Downtown Berkeley Association and the shopping climate here at NPR, National Pirate Radio.
Dedicated to David Silverman of the FCC from your friends at Pirate Radio.
We're on the streets of San Francisco today talking with people about the popular new craze sweeping the nation, Mayor Frank Jordan's Matrix Diet Plan. It's a revolutionary new approach to nutrition and exercise strictly enforced by uniformed police. With me today is a woman with a very slender figure. Tell me, Ms. Fortune, how do you do it?
Well, I eat a steady diet of service cuts, media defamation, and police abuse. And let me tell you, it keeps my reflexes sharp.
It's certainly not the traditional approach, is it?
Frank Jordan's Matrix Diet Plan does have historical precedent, but, excuse me, I gotta go.
Wow, look at her go. The mobile crisis team van drove by and she took off like a jackrabbit. It sure improves your speed trying to survive on the streets of San Francisco these days. Let's talk to another volunteer. You, sir, jogging with the full backpack on. Could I talk to you a minute?
If you could keep up.
Thanks. You
you certainly are in good shape. Where do you get your stamina?
Take a look behind us.
Oh, I see. You're being pursued by uniformed officers.
Yeah, they're kind of like my personal trainers.
Well, what happens if they catch up to you?
Well, if it's a traditional workout, they'll trash compact my belongings and haul me in for a bench warrant. It's a powerful incentive to stay moving, I'll tell you.
I can see that, sir, and thank you for your time.
So long.
Phew. Let's slow down a little and get another point of view. Here's the local cop. Excuse me, officer. What do you think of Mayor Frank Jordan's revolutionary new matrix diet plan?
Well, these local property owners are mighty grateful, and I'll tell you, I haven't paid a cent for a donut or a beer since the matrix diet plan began. And I put on 20 pounds.
So you're actually gaining weight on the matrix plan?
The police budget is fat and happy, let me tell you, and Jordan's campaign coffers are almost as full as the jails. It's a great time to be a cop.
Well, thank you, officer. Well, there you have it, folks. A lot of satisfied participants in the new Frank Jordan Matrix Diet Plan, now gaining popularity nationwide. And now, back to you in the studio.
And back to me in the studio here with Bathrobes Bureau's Broadsides. You're listening to the Jolly Roger Comedy Troupe, and we'll be hearing more of that later in the show. I'm looking now at the Food Not Bombs menu, which is a mostly monthly publication put out by Food Not Bombs of San Francisco, which a lot of interesting stuff in it. Encourage you to subscribe. You can get 6 issues of the menu for $30 if you drop a note to Food Not Bombs, 3145 Geary Boulevard, number 12, San Francisco 94118. Or give a call to 1-800-884-1136. That's 1-800-884-1136. It's toll-free. It's a collection of information from Food Not Bombs organizations across the country and to some extent across the world. And it really is, it's good stuff. It's got a lot of specifics coming up. For instance, from June 15th through 27th is, of course, the famous first ever Food Not Bombs gathering, which will be a gala ongoing affair going on in San Francisco during that 2-week period to which people are invited. You can get your schedule for that either by coming to a Food Not Bombs meeting here in Santa Cruz and asking them, or subscribing to the Food Not Bombs newsletter. And, gosh, I had all this stuff I wanted to read this morning from here, because such good writing in here, particularly, for example, by Food Not Bombs activist Katzenjammer Keith McHenry. Keith has an article that was published in the Anderson Valley Advertiser, the May 3rd issue, that is reprinted here. I'm going to read you a little, but I'm afraid I may fail before the end, but you may get the taste of it. The article is entitled End Human Rights Violations at UN Plaza. And again, for those of you just tuning in, the subject of my broadsides usually concerns itself with poverty rights, police repression against the poor, and the people struggling back, fighting back to assert basic human rights and their own human dignity. Here's this article by Keith, Anderson Valley Advertiser, May 3rd. United Nations Human Rights Commission is investigating pre-UN celebration police sweeps against the homeless and Food Not Bombs. Many community activists believe that our civil liberties should not be suspended in the wake of the tragic Oklahoma bombing. Using the excuse of the recent bombings and the UN celebration, as in San Francisco it is the 50th anniversary of the UN, and Food Not Bombs serves food down at the UN, on UN Plaza, Federal Protective Services and the San Francisco Police Department have stepped up the arrests of people who are sharing free food with the hungry. Police helicopters have also been flying above us. When we serve free food, these arrests are a clear violation of the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. The declaration was drafted in San Francisco 50 years ago this summer. Yes, the United Nations Human Rights Commission is investigating pre-UN celebration police sweeps against the homeless and Food Not Bombs. I can only imagine the reaction of those people attending the UN celebration to witnessing the San Francisco police violate the human rights of the hungry and Food Not Bombs on behalf of the UN. The continued government attacks against the homeless and Food Not Bombs shows just how much of a farce so-called democracy really is. Support for ending the arrests runs 3-1 at the many public hearings on the subject. This is remarkable when you consider that most of the people who come out and speak in favor of continued harassment are paid to attend. The San Francisco Board of Supervisors has voted twice to end the arrests. These are arrests for serving free food in San Francisco. Food Not Bombs serves there twice daily and has been harassed and arrested. Well, over 900 arrests in the course of its 8-year history in San Francisco. I was unable to reach Keith this morning on the phone, but there seems to have been a cessation of arrests within the last few weeks. This article probably was written about April events when they were again arresting people at the Food Not Bombs meals, which if you get up into San Francisco, just go to UN Plaza at noon any day, except for Saturdays and Sundays, and you'll find the Food Not Bombs there or lurking in the bushes trying to get the bagels and the rice out. So, again, check your Anderson Valley Advertiser or your Food Not Bombs menu for the rest of that article. Here's another piece from the Food Not Bombs menu about S-390, which is a bill in the Senate. S-390, also known as H.R. 896, the Omnibus Counterterrorism Bill. As you may imagine, the counterterrorism bill is another one of these hysterical attempts to expand police power on the heels of the Oklahoma bombing. Actually, they've been pushing for it before that, but now they've got some traction, unfortunately. Who opposes it? The American Civil Liberties Union, Americans for Democratic Action, the American Friends Service Committee, American Immigrant Lawyers Association, Amnesty International, the American Muslim Council, the Maryknoll Society, the Unitarian Universalists, the National Lawyers Guild, the National Committee Against Repressive Legislation, and many others. What does it do? Under the guise of countering terrorism, this bill would allow the FBI and other agencies, including the military, to investigate political groups and causes at will. This was shut down in the 70s, or supposedly shut down. It actually wasn't, but there were directives issued against it after the Watergate scandal, when the president attempted to formalize his dictatorship in the United States and didn't succeed, and Nixon was then impeached and then, of course, pardoned by his successor, Ford. But this bill, S-390 H.R. 896, the president would decide which groups are terrorist, and there would be no appeal from this decision. Consider that. Persons in any way associated with a group named as a terrorist group, for instance, those who subscribe to a publication put out by the group, could be arrested and imprisoned without due cause. They would be presumed guilty and could be held without bail. They could be tried without knowing what evidence had been given against them, and they would not have the right to confront witnesses. The government would not have to prove them guilty. They would have to prove themselves innocent. That's pretty hefty stuff. And, of course, the arguments made in favor of the bill are that we have to stop terrorism. And it's really difficult to say if anyone could have stopped that bombing at the Oklahoma federal building. But removing all our liberties, it certainly is not the way to do it. Dealing with the root causes of the disputes, the basic injustices in the world is. And if you want to fight this bill, give a call to 202-225-3121. For all you folks who have long-distance phone accounts, and say no on 390 H.R. 896. And for the rest of you who don't have phones to do this and the money to do it, just be aware that this is happening. And if you're interested in writing a letter to these creeps in Congress and urging them to get a clue, give me a call at 423-4833. And if you have any other questions about this show, or if you're interested in getting on the air here at the Radio Free Berkeley, give me a call at that number, and I will pass on the information, because I think that we need lots of different voices. Lots of different voices on the air. So what do we got here? Here's a rather depressing article many months back from USA Weekend, which talks about increased crackdown of homeless people nationwide. It's part of this general mythology that the people somehow are demanding that homeless people be excluded from public spaces. That's what the city council here in Santa Cruz claimed was the motivation for their infamous downtown ordinances last year. The laws would make it illegal to sit down on the sidewalk near a shop, make it illegal to ask for a dime after dark, make it illegal to have a political demonstration after dark that involves any kind of a table or structure. A whole series of repressive laws are in place now in Santa Cruz thanks to your liberal city council, Mayor Squawkbox, former Mayor Squawkbox Scott Kennedy, and even Mayor Bird-Sued Byers voted for all of these laws but one, the Sit on the Sidewalk law. She voted against that law, for which she should be given credit. But so far, she didn't vote against or attempt to repeal any of the other repressive laws that make it give the police more tools for harassing homeless people in public places. So, what this USA Today story says is it goes to different cities and goes into the new kinds of repression that they have legislated. Cincinnati city officials removed benches from a park to discourage the homeless from congregating. Well, Santa Cruz did that for years. HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, the organization to which I belong, has fought the Parks and Rec Department headed by Lebensraum Jim Lang, who is instrumental in having benches removed from the downtown without public hearings before the earthquake, simply because they were, quote, centers for loitering and so forth. He simply took the pressure from merchants such as Neil Coonerty of Bookshop Santa Cruz in its old location, and they removed benches from there. Leesk's, other large stores, I think across from the Metro, benches were removed on Pacific Avenue. And of course, at that time, police were walking up and down harassing people for sitting on the planters, which was illegal. And this is incidentally still partially illegal for all of you legal buffs, but probably not being enforced. I haven't heard of any tickets or harassment being issued for sitting on the planters. I have heard of people being harassed for standing under the awnings of stores, even though it is perfectly legal for anybody to stand, provided they're not blocking an entrance. Even next to the sacred property, the sacred shrines of business, which are downtown. I mean, yeah, that is legal. So if the police tell you it isn't legal, you can tell them what law are you referring to. If they tell you trespass, you can tell them that the businesses do not own the sidewalks. Not that this won't get you into more conflict and consternation. You know, I mean, that might well happen. But if this does happen to you, please give me a call at 423-4833 or 423-HUF. It's the phone I'll be at for another week, after which I will unfortunately be on my can in the street somewhere, but looking for another place. And who knows, maybe we can get the phone hooked up elsewhere and still available as a hotline. You can also give a call to Food Not Bones at 425-3345 to report incidents of harassment against poor people. Food Not Bones, as you may know, meets once a week, Thursday nights at 7:30 at La Familia Center, in case anyone's interested in joining this group or helping this group. I'm putting a plug here because I think that they are one of the most important groups in town, next to HUF, of course. Actually, perhaps in some respects, even more important than my favorite group, HUF, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, because they are actively engaged in regularly feeding people 4 or 5 days a week. And that happens, of course, on Wednesday at Cathcart and Pacific, Saturday at River and Josephine Street at 1, Sunday at the same time, River and Josephine Street at 1, which, by the way, may be disappearing because the city is now taking under consideration plans for a large shopping mall area there. And it looks like it's going to begin. The hearings are now in process, and if you're interested in knowing more about this, you should give a call to Mayor Byers at 429-3540 and ask her what the heck is going on with the attempt to cement over the garden, the organic garden, and the Food Not Bombs mural site. It's also the Caltrain property out there that Food Not Bombs has been using since 1992. So, other cities, according to this brief USA report from many months ago, are attempting to do what Santa Cruz has legislated but is not enforcing much downtown, namely a whole bunch of anti-homeless laws which police can then pick and choose to use at leisure against the people that they want to get rid of, whether they're political activists, whether they're drunks, whether they're people I don't like personally, whether they're deadheads, who are the subject of anonymous police complaints, anonymous complaints from merchants. And that's another bee in my bonnet, by the way. the Downtown Hosts program, or the Green Shirts, as they're called, who I actually find to be a rather friendly group of folks, are not so bad as individuals, but I'm finding that increasingly I'm hearing that they continue to simply act as an auxiliary to the police department, rather than being a truly neutral group or a truly helpful group, which is there to really present both sides, one to the other and the other back again. I mean, if this were really a group in the middle that was presenting the problems of homeless people on the streets to the merchants, saying, look, here's the situation, and then vice versa, acting as kind of a go-between, that would be something quite different than what we have, which is a bunch of mini wannabe cops running around in, you know, green uniforms with big grins on their faces, pretending to be friendly to everybody. And the reason this is so transparent is because Santa Cruz isn't the only city where this is done. This is a model that has been used in many different cities and is paid for by kind of coercive assessments against all the merchants in the downtown business assessment district. And it hasn't simply been done in Santa Cruz or in Berkeley, which were the two cities I was aware of where it was done. And in Berkeley, there actually are lawsuits pending against the Downtown Association. I think it's called the DTA, the Downtown Association. But it was done in Arcata, I believe, was also involved in that. This is another article I was going to read you before my voice took a dive for the worse, from the Food Not Bombs menu, which again I encourage you to consider subscribing to. This practice of hey, looks like this is a historic moment, folks. It looks like we have call-in capability. I mean, this is incredible, folks. We have call-in capability. I interrupt this show to give you this important information. You can now call Radio Free Santa Cruz at 89.3 FM. In fact, I'm going to turn the mic over to technician Skidmark Bond to announce this joyous birth of a patching phone line. He's actually calling the station right now and will shortly be on the air. We hope. This could be a moment for all of us to remember, or perhaps to forget.
I'm calling the station.
Oops, sorry, my mistake here. So we've got new technology going on the air, even as we speak here, although we do need donations here.